the Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Gehring Flores. Gaela is a practitioner in the field of international arbitration, as was I until quite recently, but I now work in the litigation finance space. Both of us serve as committee chairs of the DC Bar International Law Community. We are delighted to bring you today a new episode of the Tea on International Arbitration. We know it has been a while since our last episode. We took a little hiatus from recording because we both switched jobs, and well, that can be quite busy. So before beginning today's episode, I'd like to just take a moment to congratulate my co-host Gaela on joining the partnership of Allen and Overy. Gaela is now the co-director of the Americas International Arbitration Practice of Allen and Overy.
Thanks, Nicole. And I would like to extend a big congratulations to Nicole for her recent career move. Nicole has moved into the world of third-party funding, recently opening the DC office of Validity Finance. So while Nicole has stopped acting as counsel in international arbitration cases, she still remains quite firmly planted within the international arbitration community. She's just wearing a different hat now.
Today, we have the great honor and privilege to speak with Baiju Vazani, who, like us, has gone through a few recent career changes of his own. Baiju is an international arbitration lawyer and arbitrator based in London. For the last two decades, he has practiced out of leading law firms in Houston, Washington, D.C., London, and Moscow on some of the most prominent commercial and investor state cases. Later this fall, he will complete his move to the English Bar, where he has accepted tenancy with 20 Essex. There, he will continue his international arbitration practice now as an independent practitioner.
So, Baiju, your recent career moves have been followed quite closely within our international arbitration community, and we feel really lucky to be able to speak with you today about them because we get to ask questions about subjects that have been captivating everyone's attention for the past months, if not more. So without further ado, let's get right to it. But because I think it's an important aspect of this interview to get a complete picture and to put your recent decision to leave Ivanyan and Partners in context, I would like to go back to the beginning, or at least to 2019. Could you tell us why you decided to leave Jones Day and become the managing partner of INP?
Sure. First of all, thank you to both for having me on. It's a real honor and privilege. And congratulations to you both on your respective moves. The move from Jones Day to Ivanyan, pretty left field move. I realized that. So I was a partner at Jones Day for nearly 8 years, coming up into 2019. And I was heading up international arbitration from London. I was doing lots of work in Russia, as I know a lot of London practitioners do. And I got to know some of the big players out there, some of the people from the ministries. I'd known that since Russia's annexation of Crimea, there had been a series of cases brought against Russia by Ukrainian investors. Jones Day, by the way, had passed on those cases, as I think quite a few firms had, for the reason that we had Moscow offices. And the Moscow offices were all of the opinion that it would not be a good idea to take those cases on. So I was aware of them, I would say, from the distance. I was aware that Russia had not participated in those cases and that it had lost pretty much all of them to date. What happened at the beginning of 2019 is, for whatever reason, the government of Russia suddenly decided to participate in the cases. And they put together a task force essentially under the Ministry of Justice to defend those cases. It just so happened that someone that I had known from my work for Jones Day became sort of the head and said, Baiju, we come and lead up, right, this defense. I have to say, obviously, it was a shock to sort of be asked to do that, obviously an honor, but it was very exciting. The idea of really, you know, creating a brand new strategy under public international law for cases that had already lost. So in a sense, it was It was, we're already behind the eight ball and we're creating a new strategy to win. Absolutely cutting edge issue of, you know, the application of a bilateral investment treaty in disputed territory, disputed between the two treaty parties. Eight ongoing cases, new cases to come. That said, as much as it was exciting and interesting, you could imagine the idea of convincing my wife, my family, that I can go and live in Moscow and, you know, leave the comfort of Jones Day. Because, you know, once you're ensconced in big law, it can be hard to get off that hamster wheel. It took 5 months of convincing, but eventually I said, you know what, let's do it. And I'll tell you why, because I figured to myself that A, I deserved it in the sense that I'd done my whole career in big law. I'd played it so conservatively from day one, and big law would always be there, right? It's something that's there. And if this didn't work out, I could always go back to it. And at the same time, if I embraced this project, so living in Moscow, learning Russian, getting to know the legal community there, maybe winning, right? That would be incredible, changing the tide of something in public international law. And then even if it didn't work, or at the end of that project, for whatever reason, I would come out richer for the experience. So yeah, I made the jump, and I know it caused some shockwaves because it was a strange move. But for me, it was something that, you know, I always want a career that I can look back and say to my grandkids, hopefully one day, yeah, your granddad did some cool stuff, right? And so that's really, that's what I told myself. What would my 80-year-old self look back and say, you missed out on something, a big opportunity to do something different? And I said, no, I'm going to take it. So I did.
As everybody knows, in February of 2022, you resigned from INP. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this decision and how Russia's invasion of Ukraine fits into the puzzle. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that we started somewhere and then jumped to the end. So I want to also give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the middle as well.
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with that middle piece and then come to the invasion and my resignation. So the middle piece was, I have to say, it was awesome because it was everything I hoped it would be, in the sense of, I have to say, as much as there is now obviously a certain loathing of Russia, and understandably so, Russian culture itself, the history, the literature, the music, the food, Moscow itself is an incredible place. You know, I think it's one of the most misunderstood countries in the world, because we all grew up, you know, with the Soviet Union, I guess, and sort of this lawless Russia out of the Soviet Union. But actually within it, the depth and breadth of just amazing stuff. For those who want to explore Russia, now is obviously not a good time, but hopefully in due course, it really was amazing. So I embraced that. At the same time, the project itself was, again, incredible. We created a brand new strategy under international law. We worked with a lot of different experts. I worked with law firms around the world. We argued the cases in front of, obviously, some of the best jurists on the tribunal. Those decisions are pending. I don't know, obviously, what the decisions will be and to what extent current events will influence. I would hope not, but, you know, I think one has to be pragmatic. But then you ask the question, where did the invasion fit into the puzzle? And the answer really, Nicole, was the invasion was the full puzzle. In other words, I had to go. So it's funny, you know, looking back now, you may be sort of like the frog in the warming pan. You don't quite realizing it. But looking back now, 2021, you could kind of palpably feel slight difference, you know. So there was a lot of movement in the government to control what people did, in the sense of, you know, so Russia is a state economy. Most of the people work for the government, right? Vast majority of people, either directly or through state-owned entities, 80% roughly. They were told these are the countries to vacation in, right? So, you know, dual nationality started to be frowned upon. holding your money outside of Russia started to be frowned upon. Foreign journalists started to be cracked down upon. There started to be sort of this movement, sort of insular movement. And I have to say, obviously, look, I'm in a sense doing correlation and causation, and maybe the two don't match. But at the same time, there was a feeling that there was this movement to consolidate Russia into a particular position, perhaps for the reason that this was on the cards. It also happened with the cases. So the cases moved from the Ministry of Justice to the General Prosecutor's Office, and that had its own internal implications. But essentially, if you remember, the troops started building up at the end of 2021, and that was obviously a cause for concern everywhere, not least of which for me. You know, there were starting to be bulletins, don't go to Russia, certainly don't go to Ukraine. I was told, don't worry, it's all a big bluff, it'll be fine, or they'll go into the east where they already have control and it's all very clean and bloodless and it's all, you know, diplomacy and negotiated and it's a show of strength. And then, of course, on the 24th, you had what the president of Russia called the special operation, which was basically an all-out invasion of Ukraine. And I resigned on the 25th. So on the 24th, I called my wife, my family, and I said, look, I don't think I can carry on. I left things on the table, money, essentially. I was probably naive. I didn't have anything to walk into, right? I hadn't been doing a series of interviews and I wasn't, you know, leaving on a Friday and going to start somewhere else on a Monday. It would literally be walking away unemployed, essentially, for the first time in 20 years. But it was one of those times in life where, you know, I thought, hey, look, it's the right thing to do. And as a lawyer, sometimes we represent parties that, you know, are not altogether the best moral actors. We're defending rights, but at the same time, you know, maybe if we were using our own conscience, we wouldn't necessarily vote the same way as we're arguing, but that's our job, right? To argue rights, even if we don't necessarily agree with it personally. But in this case, I got to do something that was sort of my minuscule one-man protest, which was to say, yeah, I don't want to be a part of this. And I thought to myself, like, I could defend Crimea. You know, obviously there are public international issues with Crimea, but it was bloodless. There was at least a referendum. There's at least a colorable argument of self-determination. You know, it was a part of Russia up until, I think, the 60s. Most of the people there wanted and still want to be a part of Russia. And there was sort of a rationale for why one would defend Russia's interest and rights in that. Whatever the tribunal found, for or against you, one could stand up credibly as a lawyer and with a straight face and say, here are the arguments under international law. I don't think that is the case with this, right? And I didn't want to be there and to be seen in any way to be promoting, fostering, or even endorsing any of those actions. That said, since my resignation, of course, I know people in other parts of the world, Latin America, China, India, and the difference with which they see this conflict is very interesting. Unlike, for example, those of us in North America or Western Europe or Eastern Europe, where, you know, it's not this black and white issue that we see it for. So it's interesting that, in a sense, what I thought was the right thing to do, others may have said, others from other parts of the world, you know, would have said it was completely unnecessary. But, you know, I think that's maybe a debate for another day.
I think this, your leaving INP and leaving, I guess, quite literally, you know, money on the table, leaving the hamster wheel of law, you know, of a thriving law practice. And, you know, I think for what a lot of us becomes an economic security blanket. Now, you know, you made the decision that you made for moral reasons. You just thought that you could not represent those interests anymore. And there are some other law firms that have made similar decisions and individuals who've made similar decisions to leave the representation of Russia or Russian-owned or Russian-associated interests or entities. There are other people who have decided to maintain those relationships and that representation as well. And I know that many times, particularly in big law, when lawyers might be faced with somewhat moral decisions as to who they represent, a lot of times the phrase, you know, well, everyone is entitled to a good defense comes up. And I wanted to ask you about your thoughts about that. For me, I've seen a lot of conflation with that phrase, because that phrase, one would think, comes from the very US-centric notion of indigent criminal defendants being entitled to a good defense. And somehow that's bled into things that are not that are not in that sphere. One, and if I can make this even more complicated, a couple of weeks ago, I attended the Summit of the Americas in LA, and I had the opportunity to listen to the new president of Chile speaking on the subject of just how do we go forward in this extremely divided world, this divide, you know, if you're just looking at the US, but you can look at a lot of countries these days and you see ideologies on two extremes. And he said, you know, he focused on the idea of tolerance and the idea that even if you have you're very strongly committed to certain ideologies, if you're looking to move forward as a country, you might not be able to write home and say, I kept my ideology clean, like I didn't give in on anything. You might actually have to sit down and get a little dirty and compromise, essentially. And I challenged him a little bit on that because I said, well, okay, but what are the limits? And so I guess, like, in the context of that soup of things, you know, everyone's entitled to a good defense. You're going to need to get maybe a little dirty ideologically.
Yeah.
Where do you see that playing out in this mess?
Yeah, no, and it's a great question. And of course, there are no right or wrong answers. In the United Kingdom, we have something called the cab rank rule, which is very similar, I think, to the US rule. It comes from the black taxi cab. So everyone knows the black taxi cab in London. So the idea is that if you hail a black cab on the street, he or she driving cannot choose, you know, who to take and who not to take. They must take you if it's within the boundaries of, you know, a certain distance. So they can't say, no, I don't want to go to East London, or I don't want to take you because you're wearing a blue hat. They can't do that, right? And so we've extended that to certain lawyers, particularly barristers. But that is quite a limited rule in the sense that, you know, we want to make sure, as I think everyone does, that everyone has certain minimum rights of due process, particularly criminals, right? So, and that is a sort of due process rule of law in every country in the world. And of course, we champion those, looking back, for example, when, you know, civil rights actions were frowned upon, right? So, and the lawyers who said, well, I'm going to take on the case of this person at a time where it was unpopular, which we now look upon that was championing rights, and well done to that person for not giving in to populist demand. And so there is this idea, and it's correct, that lawyers should not listen to the noise, but should stick to prosecuting and defending rights. And that's what we do. Now, what I think what has happened is that particularly big law, who are a business, okay, above everything else, we are a business, and increasingly so, right? So both of you have been partners in big law, and you know that from the time we started to today, there's so much more focus on leverage and realization rate and partners' profits, and it is becoming the business of law, and the business of law cares about the bottom line. And so you can use that championing of lawyers as just doing our job for rights, right? To essentially enable bad moral actors. So I think there's a really fine balance between doing the cab rank rule and doing what people in 20 years are going to look back on and say, wow, good for you. I'm so glad you stood up for that, to enabling bad things. So, you know, particularly, for example, in the United Kingdom, defamation, right, has been a way that big companies or individuals have kept their bad actions out of the public eye is by using lawyers to threaten defamation actions. You've got big corporations who act for, you know, people that we now look back on and say, and, you know, maybe in 100 years, people will look back on and say, well, how can you defend those kind of people? But the question is, and this is the question you put to me, who's to say who's good and who's not good, right? The tobacco industry, the arms industry, fossil fuels, Russia, you know, who's to say that those are good or bad and are deserving of lawyers or not deserving of lawyers? So I think ultimately I fall down on the side of, I fall down on the side of if there is a right to be prosecuted or defended, then I think as a lawyer, you have a right to make business, right? To do your trade, to argue the rights. However, it's your personal choice. Where I feel bad for are the associates who are being told, and increasingly generations below ours, I don't want to age you guys in the same bracket as me, but you know, our generation, I think we are certainly less aware than the generations below us, right, of environmental issues and social issues. And I feel so bad for those kids now going into big law, because what do you do? What do you do if, you know, you're defending fossil fuels or you're defending tobacco? Do you say, I'm not going to do that? God, that's career limiting. So I think it's a really, really tough question. I think it's one that big law is going to have to grapple with, because in order to attract those kids, those best kids out of law school, I don't think those kids are any more willing to do, I think, maybe what our generation was, which was, we'll do it, right? We want to progress in our career. We're game, right? I think generations below us are no longer willing to do that. And I think there's a real movement now to, as you said, not doing the things that are ideologically a little bit bad. But then again, the question is, how do you run a business? Because, you know, doing things a little ideologically bad tends to pay better for obvious reasons. So it's a real balance. And maybe the answer is we'll get boutiques that do the Lord's work and big law stays where it is, which is defending entrenched rights, which includes those that are maybe ideologically dirty. But ultimately, for Russia, coming back to Russia, I don't think anyone has the right to a lawyer of its choice, right? So if no one wants to defend you, that's that you have a right to a lawyer. And Russia has Russian lawyers, right? So they have local Russian lawyers. So I don't feel bad for Russia that all these slew of fantastic London lawyers and the US lawyers kind of pulled out and said, well, we don't want to deal with you anymore. I don't feel bad for them at all. They have lawyers. Not that. So I disagree with some people who say, well, that's against the rule of law, because Russia has not the law. No, it doesn't have lawyers of its choice. It has lawyers. And for me, that's just a marketplace.
I could continue down this line forever with you, but it's
such a great topic. It really is. But I think it's one that, as I said, I think big law is going to have a sort of, if not a comeuppance, there's going to be a day of reckoning with younger lawyers and specific issues. So you have seen that in the past, right? With yep. Defense of Marriage Act, or Trump administration, or anything that is seen as divisive, and whether your law firm is in or out, and how do you feel about it? You will get resignations. You will get people who don't. And so I think that you will come to see law firms defined by who they choose to represent.
Yeah. Well, and I guess if I could just follow up on the notion that, you know, lawyers should step up when they're being asked to defend legal rights. I guess my question there is, okay, you know, if there are, you know, if you have this entity that that maybe is a little ideologically dirty and they do have legal rights to defend, that's maybe in one bucket, one context. But what if you have a somewhat ideologically dirty entity that wants its lawyers to push the envelope, you know, let just as a maybe US stereotype would be the way in which law firms essentially worked to change the understanding of the Second Amendment with respect to gun control and what the Second Amendment means. You know, I'm sure there are some people who would say, well, they were just defending their Second Amendment rights. I think other people would say they were creating a new concept of that right, you know, and they had choices there. Yeah. To do that.
So I would never and have never looked down on any lawyer that subject to their own ethical bylaws, right? Because, you know, we can't argue things that are frivolous, right? So we have to argue something that has some at least some colorable merit to it. Any lawyer that does that, I wouldn't do it, but I think that person is entitled to do a job. is the way I see it. Maybe that's a very capitalist view of my profession, but I, and there are some people who say, well, you know, the lawyers sort of looking down on our profession, right? And say, well, look, they're doing stuff that's essentially what you said is bad. But I think they're putting bread on the table for their families, right? In other words, I think we're all here to do a job subject to ethical guidance, and of course we shouldn't breach that, but then it's ultimately for the judge or the tribunal to decide whether or not that argument is right or wrong. We're simply advocating for our client, and that's that. Just the final point on that is I have to say I also believe in the fact that we as lawyers are not us, right? When I'm sitting there in trial, I am my client. So when words come out of my mouth, I am the mouthpiece for my clients. I'm arguing his or her or its rights. I'm not arguing for me. So whether you believe me or not, that's for the judge to decide, but I'm not advocating for myself. So if anyone says to me, how could you say those things? Well, that's because those are the rights I'm arguing on, but I'm sort of morphed. If one could have sort of a special effects, I'd sort of take on the face of my client and I would be them arguing the case. And I really do believe that. So I also believe in the right for a lawyer to argue something in the morning and something different and the exact opposite in the afternoon, because I think we're not arguing for ourselves, we're arguing for our client.
Yeah. And I think we've all been in that position and would fully agree with that. We have started down this path, so I'm now going to sort of jump ahead in my own little script here and ask you a little bit about your writings on mentorship, since we've sort of segued already into the law firm life. And I know you've written for a long time on LinkedIn and elsewhere, I'm sure, about the importance of good mentorship and being, if you will, a good law firm citizen, which is sort of the other side of the hat, when you do get to represent yourself and be yourself and work within the system and you're not just the mouthpiece of your client. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that project and why you started it. What did you hope it would achieve? Do you think your goals in publishing the series were realized? Maybe you could just address that for a bit.
Yeah, so I remember exactly it was December 31st, 2020. I opened LinkedIn and I saw a post from a woman who said that she had posted every day for 365 days as a sort of an experiment. And she had had so much engagement and so much sort of learning and fun over that experience. And she thought it was brilliant. Sort of, and I thought to myself, you know what? If she can post every day, I can surely post once a week. And I had, having come out of big law and safely knowing, of course, you know, this may come back to haunt me in 5 years when I'm back in big law, but hopefully not. But having come out of big law, I said to myself, you know what? I know things, but now I can say things. And I can say things that I wish that I had known when I was a first year associate or a fifth year associate or a junior partner. because I've been through the process and I have an insight. So what if I just put it out there every week for a year and see what happens? And maybe no one will read it, or maybe I'll get laughed out of town. I don't know. Let's give it a go. And it was so incredible, the reception that it got, to the point actually where I have, like you took a hiatus of this podcast, I have taken a hiatus in my LinkedIn series, and I get messages every week saying, can you get back on it? Can you get back on it? So I've got to get back on that horse in the next few weeks. Have I fully realized everything? No, I've got lots more to say, but I'll tell you what's been incredible is that I'll go to a conference and I'll be sitting, having a coffee, minding my own business. Someone I have no idea, they don't know me, I don't know them. They'll come up to me and they said, you know, in mentoring series number 32, you said something, I was having exactly that issue, and I read what you said and it gave me clarity, or it gave me comfort, or whatever it was. And I was like, wow, you know, like something I'd written in my kitchen over breakfast had meant something to someone in a material and meaningful way, was so moving in a way that I hadn't previously experienced, right? I've won cases for clients where, you know, you hand them a check and say congratulations or vindicate their rights, and that's a fantastic feeling, or at work where you've promoted someone or done something, you know. But the idea that you could touch someone with your words and help them that you don't know, who are thousands of miles away from you, just from your own experiences, made me realize actually it's not just a thing that I do, but it's actually a privilege and maybe even a duty to keep doing it, to give people, and I'll keep doing it as long as it keeps helping, right? I've tried to keep it authentic. I think that's the key. I'm not trying to be some guru, or, you know, pretend to have the answers, you know, the key to the lock. I'm just saying, here's how I see things. And so hopefully I'll keep doing that. I would love to turn it into a book at some stage, but yeah, I hope it continues long into the future.
Just the other day, my oldest daughter actually came to me and asked if I was disappointed that she wasn't particularly interested in going into the law. And none of my kids, in fact, are interested in going into the law, which might not be surprising given that I'm in big law. Their dad is in law as well. So having two parents as lawyers is, I think, tough. But I guess I wanted to ask you, given your writing on mentorship, do you hope that your kids go into law, or do you hope that they actually don't?
Absolutely, I hope that they don't.
That's what I told my daughter. I'm not disappointed at all.
And I also tell my children not to. And I was told not to by my dad, who was a lawyer, which is interesting.
Which is really, in a way, really sad, right? It's a bit of an indictment of our profession that we don't wish our lives on our kids. But you know what it is? I'll retract my statement. I wouldn't discourage them to do that. What I would say is that I want them to do what they want to do. So I came from what is popularly known as a tiger mother, who, you know, insisted. So I'm a lawyer. My brother's a doctor. Classic Indian family. I went to Oxford, he went to Cambridge. It was absolutely, you know, the dream of my mum. Am I happier that I'm, you know, an international as opposed to, I don't know, a poet or, you know, a painter or, I don't know, an English teacher? I don't think so. So all I tell my kids now is actually, you know, do the best you want to do, but whatever profession is for you, you go for it, and I will support you in that. I'm really trying to be consciously different and sort of encourage them to do, because I think today it's so different than, again, and again, I'm aging you guys, and I'm so sorry for this, but it's different in the sense that there are so many different professions today, you know, which don't need an office, which just need an internet connection, which allow you to be freelance or much more in control and flexibility of your time. And I think as a lawyer, the one thing that I don't like, and actually the reason I'm becoming a barrister as opposed to going back into the comfort, as you said, Gaila, of big law, is flexibility of time. Because your time is not your own. you know, we sell our time. And that means that one has to have enough time to sell rather than the product, right? And I think that is where, you know, we strive to achieve, we strive to be perfect. And I think that combination of time and striving to be perfect means that we just are very anxious and very keen to please over periods of time. So I think it's a very difficult profession over the long term. And I have to give kudos to people who, you know, are in big law into their 70s. I mean, I don't think I could ever have done that. So for me, the being a barrister is great because I get to pick and choose the cases I work on. I get to be more flexible with my time. And so for me, it's sort of almost a nod to what I think are the professions of the future, which are the ones where you can be on a beach in Thailand, right? And work for 2-3 hours in the morning and, you know, get whatever project you get. And then you can go and do other stuff that interests you. And I hope my kids follow that kind of lifestyle than the ones we sometimes believe is sort of the traditional professions where one has to be in the hospital or the office slaving away.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly in the wake of the COVID pandemic and, you know, one of the things that's come out of the pandemic for sure in big law is a focus on improving, changing firm culture, people working virtually, trying to figure out how much time to spend in person versus virtually, allowing people more flexibility in their schedules. But one of the things that certainly endured throughout this entire time, throughout the pandemic, and certainly in the US during the Black Lives Matter movement spike, you know, which certainly still exists, but there was quite an intense time after George Floyd's death and Breonna Taylor's death. And that challenge is diversity, you know, and not as we've kind of evolved over time and become to understand things over time, not just diversity, but diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I certainly know you, Baiju, as one of the most ardent supporters and promoters of diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, I've seen what you've written about it. And in your responses to perhaps posts of people who are towing maybe a more conservative line with respect to diversity. And I guess I just wanted to ask you, do you think that anyone these days, particularly in big law, is getting it right? And what do you think the focus needs to be to advance this in a meaningful way in the future?
Yeah, it's such a huge topic. And it's one that is, I mean, straight to my heart, right? So I'm a kid of immigrants and I grew up in 1970s, 1980s London, which was racist central. So I had my fair share of incidents, which obviously shaped me, to which when I tell my kids these days, they're just shocked, right? So what I, first of all, what I say I'm super thankful for is we are not where we were 40, 50 years ago, right? When I was a kid. So I think we should certainly celebrate and recognize the progress. And as much as there is a backlash of people, if you are woke or a snowflake or, you know, politically correct, this idea that these things are bad, I welcome that. I don't mind even the virtue signaling sometimes of some of the brands and some of the law firms and saying, look at us, and we have this woman as head of this, or we have this, in England we say BAME, but in America we say lawyers of color, as head of this, right? And okay, so you've got the one person, and you've got the two people, and that's supposed to be a sick, but it's okay. I always pressed in LinkedIn, I pressed the celebrate button, because that is going to create change. Even those small steps are really, really important. Where I think everyone is getting it right is in the recruitment, starting with law schools, right? So I think law schools, so you get the, and I'll just say diversity, but by that I mean literally all types of diversity, reflective of the US or the world population coming into law school. So you have the right percentages that are reflective of, or even better, not reflective, because if we have much more of of minority or women, then so much the better to challenge what is already established. So you're getting the right, law schools are doing well, okay? The question then is recruitment. I think recruitment is doing so much better than it was. I used to hate this notion that, well, you know, we're going to have to change our grading system. Well, we're going to have to look at different schools that we don't traditionally look at. That's nonsense. Thankfully, what I used to hear 20 years ago when I was recruiting law school, that has changed. So that's dropped. Fantastic. So now you get these bright kids coming through, and they are bright-eyed and they believe they're going to make a difference, right? So you get into the system. I think that's where the system works up until that point. But then you look at, then let's fast forward, right? Let's look at women or minorities as equity partners. Terrible. Let's look at the partner makeup. Terrible. So we're getting leakage in the pipe. And the question is, why are we getting leakage in the pipe? Okay, you're going to have some natural leakage in the pipe. People are going to go do something else. But the question is, why is it more women who are leaving? Why is it more minority ethnic people who are leaving? And there, I think it's about how opportunities for work are given out. So it's very interesting. I read something yesterday of the culture in London, for example, right? So you guys have been to London a lot. So we have a pub culture, right? We have a drinking culture. And it's traditional. Believe me, it's been here since the 15th century, right? You go to the tavern, you have your ale, or in the 17th century, it was gin. You know, and you still have it. You still have pub events. People go, let's go to the pub for a pint. That's sort of a British thing. And you know what? Work is given out by the partners at that event. Now, if you don't drink, right, or you've got to go home to look after your kids, you're not at the pub, and therefore you're not getting the plum opportunity. So I think you've got a problem of how advancement and inclusion is created into the system. So whether one has a black book, whereas work is given out not by a partner giving patronage, saying you do this, you do this, you do this, but rather by a gatekeeper who makes sure that it is equal. But there, I have to say, I think that's difficult, because as a partner, I want a particular associate to do a particular job, right? I hired that associate because they are smart. I don't want someone else's associate, right? I think that's very difficult. So in a sense, the question is, how does one, it's very easy to have silos, to have individual rainmakers, to have partners who have teams, who bring in good work. Say, you go ahead and choose who you want to work on your cases, as opposed to a systemic way of making sure that opportunities are given out properly. And I think law firms have not come to grips with how to balance those two propositions. And I think for too long, we've left rainmakers alone. And I remember at all my law firms, rainmakers were given so much leeway. They could get away with so much bad stuff, some of which was giving the work to their favorites. Right. And the favorites, of course, would be people who looked like them, sounded like them, talked like them, that they felt comfortable with, who would travel with them, who would hang out with them on the weekends. And that system continues and continues because it makes the firm money. And I personally, I don't know how to fix that. But I will say one thing as a sort of ending, which is I said that I love the idea that we are now all woke. Right? We're all, you know, we do, you know, the rainbow for pride. We do, you know, Women's Day. You know, we're just really in tune with all these events. I think that's fabulous. What I don't like, I have to say, is I go to diversity events, and you know who's on the panel? Diverse people. You know what I want to see? I want to see 5 white men on a panel about diversity. Because we can sit there and talk to each other in an echo chamber, right? And say, oh, we need diversity. But obviously I'm going to say that because I believe it and it's part of who I am. But what we need is the allies to be doing it, because they are the ones who have the power. They are the ones who can make the change. And I don't know why diversity events, any diversity panel you go to, you will never see, right, a panel who is not diverse. And for me, it should be exactly the opposite. We should be seeing the leaders of law firms, those, you know, those men in their 60s who are, you know, CEOs, you know, as they say, there are more CEOs named David or Tim than there are women CEOs, right? Those are the guys who should be on the panel saying, listen, I want change, right? Not us guys who are saying, we want to see more people like us, because that for me then, and the people in the audience are then diverse, and then we're just talking amongst ourselves. And I think that's where we, instead of talking to each other, we should be bringing those allies on board, because I think that's how you make proper change.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And there's, to the extent that you noted that particularly in big law, you're selling your time. And if big law is essentially laying the issue of diversity in the laps of those few, relatively few diverse attorneys, then they're spending more of their time trying to fix a problem that, frankly, they didn't create. It's not their problem to fix. So yeah, absolutely. The notion that, you know, that white men and older white men should be doing their fair share, which arguably is all of it, to fix the problem. That definitely makes sense to me, resonates quite a bit with me. Yeah.
Because when, you know, there's two things. One, when someone speaks against their own interests, people listen, right? Because I think there's a danger of saying, well, of course you'd say that because it's good for you, right? So why don't if an older white gentleman said, I think we need more women, more minority ethnic representation, people would listen, because it's not in his interest. That is against his interest. So that makes him all the more credible. So I think that's super important. The other thing that irritated me when I was head of diversity of one law firm was that, you know, they'd come to me for the diversity angle. Like I was the only one who could give the answer, you know, like I'm the only one who has the answer to the algebra equation. Why don't you tell me, right? It's not as if just because I've got brown skin, I know the diversity angle. It is staring you in the face. So that kind of also irritated me, that it's almost like diversity issues is for diverse people. You know, we're the ones who have to say what is or is not right. And I think it should literally be for everyone.
On that note, we've come to the end of our questions. So I was just going to ask you the question we'd like to ask all of our guests, which is, you know, other than the things that we've been talking about today, what is keeping you awake at night these days? And if you feel like we've already covered that, I'm going to let you take a pass, but only if you tell us your favorite Russian novel.
rather than the Russian novel. By the way, I tell you, my favorite author is Dostoevsky. Absolutely fabulous. My Russian is getting better, such that I'm trying to read Dostoevsky in the native language. But I'll tell you what's keeping me awake a little bit, and you guys will maybe feel this, is the decision to go solo as a barrister, which is essentially a sole practitioner. And it's coming out of your comfort zone. Nicole, you are coming out of your comfort zone, right? To do something very different.
100%.
Yeah, and I'm doing the same. And so it's like, will anyone hire me? Right. So, you know, sort of that that little voice in your head saying, but you're a big law partner, right? That's what you've been for 20 years. Why are you going out and doing something different? And will it work? But for me, actually, that keeps me awake at night, but it also gives me the energy and the adrenaline to say, no, I'm going to try something different. And I think that also, that anxiety also drives you on. So it's keeping me awake, but it's also the fuel to my fire.
Well, Baijiu, we absolutely wish you all the luck in the world, although I, for one, don't think you need it, but I can absolutely understand the nerves about stepping outside that comfort zone, which I still haven't done yet. So I really admire you, and I admire Nicole for coming off that hamster wheel. But, you know, I just really wanted to thank you, Baijiu, for speaking with us today on The Tea, and also wanted to thank the DC Bar. To check out more of what DC Bar communities have to offer, please visit dcbar.org/communities. And you have been listening to the Tea on International Arbitration. Watch out for new episodes. And if you like this episode, please tell a friend about it and subscribe at anchor.fm/dcbartea or anywhere you access your podcasts.